Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 458, Interview with Lucy Commissar about Offshore Banking. This is being recorded on May 2nd of the year 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present investigative journalist Lucy Commissar. Lucy, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Now, inside one of our discussion, we were talking about a fellow who's had a lot of press, but as you reveal in your article, someone who whose story has only been very incompletely relayed in the United States. If you could develop for us the story of Mikhail Khodorkovsky and the individuals and firms in the rogue gallery of which he was part, names like Menatep, which we talked about, Yukos, Valmet, individuals, and I don't know the pronunciations, Mr. Konakin, Elena Konges Popova, Semyon Mogilevich, and Kenneth Dart.
Yeah, well, okay, it's Mikhail Khodorkovsky and Elena Kolonga Popova, who are two stars in an interesting little drama that is being played out now. So let me tell you briefly, because you probably didn't read about it in the newspapers here. There, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the richest man in Russia, something like $11 billion is the number they give out now, had started Menatep Bank at the time of the collapse, just after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and went on to buy Yukos, big oil company, in one of these phony loans for share auctions where they paid a few hundred million for something that was actually worth billions. Now, he is in jail now because of tax evasion. The Russians have him in jail. And there's a little-known woman named Elena Kolong-Popova, a Russian who married a French diplomat, came to France, divorced the diplomat, and happened to meet one of Khodorkovsky's colleagues and confederates in France, a man named Golubovich. And he hired her to be his money launderer, actually. She set up offshore companies and bank accounts in places like Switzerland and the Bahamas, so that the people she was working for, it was basically the Menatep Group. They kept the same name, but now it was the Menatep Group, not the bank, which in 98 went bankrupt. And she set up this operation, and she showed me documents which show the insider trading of how their companies, which she set up, were buying and selling shares of the stocks that of the companies they controlled. And this, of course, is looked on askance when you basically are pumping up your stock by buying and selling it with phony shell companies. Most of the companies she set up were in Switzerland or other places offshore, but she had something going in France, and there was money moving through accounts in France. The French tax police are very efficient, and they found this out. And they did a raid on her apartment and found a lot of interesting documents, and then informed her that she owed 15 million euros. At that time, it was about $15 million. Now it's even more dollars in back taxes. And she said, "But this isn't my money. I'm just the straw man for these other characters." And she went to Golubovich, Alexei Golubovich, and said, "Hey, you know, tell them that this is." Your money, it's your company," and he said, in whatever the Russian equivalent is, "Take a walk." So then she was contacted by the Russians, who were at this time looking into Khodorkovsky's operations, and they said, "Well, you know, you could be considered an accessory to the crime that we have been investigating." And on both sides, they made her an offer she couldn't refuse, which was to provide as much information as she had to the Russians and the French. And that's what she did, and she also showed me her information, which I've just described to you, or at least some of it. And they were using a big bank in Geneva to move this money, a bank called Bank Leu, L-E-U. Now, the American press all this time has been writing about poor Mr. Khodorkovsky, how he is a victim, and he's practically been sainted. But the evidence that the Russians and the French have show very clearly that the man is a crook. And he's a crook not only because he cheated the Russian tax authorities, he cheated Western investors who have bought shares in the companies that whose stock he was manipulating through the shell companies.
This is a point I want to underscore, Lucy, for the benefit of the listeners, because there has been a lot written about Mr. Khodorkovsky in the Western press, but most of the articles and a lot of the editorialization that has taken place sort of cast the jailing of Khodorkovsky in the light of Putin was representing Mr. Putin was representing a return to the bad old days of Soviet era repression, and that basically they were trying to block out the clear sunshine of free enterprise in favor of, this, that, and the other thing. Whereas, in fact, as you point out in your article, this was the focal point of a huge criminal operation, and one that had very serious implications, not just for people in Russia, but for people in the West as well.
That's right. For the investors. The investors ought to care that this operation was cheating them.
One of the names, a New York Times article about this mentioned that one of the many names that intersected with this particular milieu was the ubiquitous Carlyle Group that a lot of listeners may be familiar with. One of the powerful individuals who's now, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Lucy, he is the chairman of Clearstream International. That's a fellow named Robert Douglas. Tell us about him, if you would.
Well, Robert Douglas is he used to be at Chase Bank. And then he went to the company that is the law firm of Chase was on the board, by the way, of Clearstream. Then he went to the company that was the law firm of Chase Bank. And I did try to Milbank Tweed, a very famous law firm. I did try to talk to him about what's been going on in Clearstream, but he has refused my calls. I called him repeatedly at the office of Milbank Tweed. Milbank Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy,
and
with offices at One Chase Manhattan Plaza, because, as I said, it's connected to Chase Bank, and he is not interested in discussing what's going on in Clearstream.
By the way, that McCloy is, as in John J. McCloy, a name that will be familiar to veteran listeners, a person who's had his fingers knuckle deep in many of the more sinister pies that were baked in the second half of the 20th century. And so he is basically the chairman of Clearstream as of this point.
The chairman of Clearstream International, yes.
Right. So he's sort of the hen that's sitting on top of all of these clandestine golden eggs, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that we touched on in the first side was a Taiwanese deal for some French-made naval frigates. This was another of the scams that went through Clearstream. If you could detail this for us, Lucy, bearing in mind that a lot of the details are not familiar to many listeners, if you could give us the outlines of this deal, how it relates to Clearstream, and what happened, including a murder that appears to have been connected to this case.
Indeed. The French company Thompson wanted to sell frigates, warships, to Taiwan. But French foreign policy said that wasn't a good idea because the French wanted to be good friends with the Chinese, which doesn't look very happily at countries that sell military equipment to Taiwan. So the job of Thompson was to change the mind of the French government. At the time, Roland Dumas, who was the foreign minister of France, had a girlfriend named Christiane de Vieux-Joncourt, and she was hired by Elf, the oil company. This gets rather convoluted, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
She was hired by Elf, the oil company, basically because she was the mistress of Roland Dumas, and this was the way that they could communicate with a powerful man in the French government. Thompson, the arms company, knew this and went to Alfred Sirvan, an official, a top official of ELF, who, by the way, is presently in jail, to see if he could get Christiane de Vieux-Joncourt to persuade Roland Dumas to approve the sale of the frigates. And after some time, he indeed did, and the payoff for ELF and Christiane de Vieux-Joncourt was some millions of dollars, and Dumas got some benefit out of that as well. Famously, he got a pair of cowboy boots or shoes, I think, worth over $1,000, and he got a statue. That all went to trial. in France, and of course he ended up getting the charges knocked down, and he's not going to jail. But in Taiwan, the story was revealed because the naval captain in the Navy, who was the auditor in the Taiwan Navy, looked at the prices for these frigates, which came to $4 to $6 billion, but it turned out that a large percentage, perhaps over a billion, was more than what the market price should have been. Of course, those were the bribes and kickbacks, and he brought this to the attention of some superiors and said, why are we paying so much more for these frigates than anybody else is paying? They're apparently some standard item, and Thompson was selling them to other countries, and the auditor's job was to look at that. Well, his body ended up being washed onto the beach of the China Sea. An investigation ensued. In the end, a dozen or more Taiwanese military and officials went to jail, and the investigation, of course, also took place in France, where there was not so much seriousness, it seems, in putting top officials in jail. They looked at Dumas, but nothing happened to him. But there were some links that seemed to go to some higher officials, and the courts never moved to that. One reason was when the judges asked to look at the books, the government of France refused and said this was a national security secret, so that the books on the French side, because, of course, any kind of military sales was controlled by the French government, the judge was not allowed to look at the books. And he was denied this over a period of years, both by conservative and socialist ministers. Another thing that happened is that there was a man named Thierry Ambaud. He was a member of French intelligence, and he had been assigned to Taiwan. And he learned a good deal of information. And one day, he was in his apartment, and they said that he was trying to fix a shutter late at night, or maybe he just tripped. He fell out of the window. His father, General Ambaud, is a former head of French intelligence, and he says his son did not fall out of any window, but he died.
Oh, how was the last name spelled, Lucy?
Excuse me?
How is Monsieur Ambaud's last name spelled?
Ambaud, I-M-B-O-T.
Okay, fine. Okay, good. By the way, I would note for the benefit of veteran listeners that some of the people, and particularly Monsieur Servin, is a name that also cropped up in connection with the CDU funding scandal that we've spoken about in a number of past broadcasts, and listeners can access that from the archive programs on the WFMU download site. Lucy, one of the things that you write about in your article...
Well, let me add one thing.
Go ahead.
A man named Joël Boucher had been the deputy manager of the Société Générale branch in Taiwan. He got pretty disgusted with the goings-on, and he gave the Taiwanese information that his bank had been used to move kickbacks back to France through Clearstream. So here we get back to Clearstream again, the river that washes.
Or in some cases, apparently, at least some of the tributary waters would appear to be washing up the occasional body of the auditor who gets in the way, huh? As the fellow did in Taiwan. One of the things that you write about in your article on offshore banking was the genesis of Swiss banking secrecy. And one of the things that apparently generated that was an uproar. Once again, we're talking about France, but this in the period leading up to World War II. I wonder if you'd detail that for us.
Yeah. We're talking about 1932, and the French police raided an apartment in the neighborhood of the Champs-Élysées, where the officials of a Swiss bank had five rooms which they were using to meet their French customers. And the police found a lot of money, but they also found an index, a file, and 10 large notebooks with 2,000 names. And this was discussed on the floors of the National Assembly when a member of Parliament denounced the tax evasion by these French people who had their names in the book, because the reason they were putting their money in Swiss banks was to evade taxes in France. And they included politicians, judges, industrialists, church leaders. directors of newspapers. Among the people were the director of a paper called Le Matin. There were the Peugeot brothers, the makers of the car. There was Henriette François Coty of the perfume family. So it was a major scandal in France. But then it was a big problem for the Swiss bankers because they were selling confidentiality, discretion. They weren't going to get customers if these accounts could be known. And they feared that the money would just go someplace else. So the legislature in Switzerland developed a plan to make sure banking secrecy would be established. And 2 years later, in 1934, the Swiss Confederation made it a crime for any bank employee to violate the secrecy of clients' identities. And even law enforcement, if law enforcement agents were on the track of thieves, they could not get through this bank secrecy. So the tax cheaters, the elites of France and other countries, could now rest easy because they would continue not to pay their taxes.
And some of these same institutions were also involved with helping to fund Adolf Hitler, whose forces overran France some years later.
Yes, of course. Swiss banks were used to finance Hitler, and this was detailed recently in a report by the Swiss legislature.
Moving now from Switzerland and moving to some of the mechanisms, obviously we've spent a good deal of time on the Clearstream Network and how their unpublished accounts serve to hide capital operations from taxation, regulation, law enforcement, and so forth. A couple of the mechanisms involved in some of these offshore banking operations and evasive financing. Lucy, tell us about transfer pricing and the Bermuda inversion, two of the strategems involved in this.
Yes, these are two ways that corporations cheat, and you should know that the significance of this is that, for example, the GAO, the General Accounting Office of the Congress, just a week or so ago came out with a report that showed that from 1996 to including 2000, that's 5 years, almost two-thirds of companies, American and foreign companies doing business in the United States, so this includes the multinationals, almost two-thirds paid zero taxes. And the corporations in the U.S. used to pay a substantial percentage of the country's taxes, and now it's quite minimal, and that means everybody else pays a good deal more. So when you're paying your taxes, you should be quite aware that they're higher because the corporations are cheating. Now, let me give you an idea of how they're cheating. Two American professors did a study ago. They got the figures from customs and on what the declared import prices and export prices were for certain items. They were aggregates, so they didn't get them for one company, but they put them together, and then they figured out that if these declared import prices and export prices were correct, companies were buying multiple vitamins from China at $850 a pound. They were buying plastic buckets from the Czech Republic for $973 each. They were buying tissues from China at $1,874 a pound. They were buying a cotton dish towel from Pakistan for $154. Then on the other side, when they were exporting, they were selling multiple vitamins to Finland for 61 cents a pound. They were selling bus and truck tires to Britain for $11.74 each, color video monitors to Pakistan for $21.90, prefab buildings to Trinidad for $1.20 apiece. Now, if they were paying the real prices for imports and getting the real prices based on the market for these items, the U.S. would be getting $53 billion more in taxes just for that 1 year, $53 billion. That's the cheating that's involved. Now, how do they do that? Because they're not really paying Pakistan company $154 for a dish towel. So what kind of paperwork can they use to show that that's what they paid for a dish towel? It's not the real paperwork. They do it through transfer pricing. They have a trading company on some offshore, in some offshore jurisdiction like Grand Cayman or Jersey or Switzerland or any one of the 50 or 60 places where you can have corporate secrecy and banking secrecy. And this trading company, the ABC Trading Company, buys the dish towel from Pakistan for the real price. Maybe it's 25 cents for a cotton dish towel at wholesale. Then they turn around and make a phony invoice for the American company and sell it to them, quote sell, but not really, for $154 a dish towel. This shell company is either owned by the American importer or it's a service company that does this kind of dirty dealing for any company that wants to use its services of phoning up the invoices. The other point about transfer pricing is another statistic, that half of international trade is not between different companies, it is within the same company. And that is, again, because they use offshore venues in order to move the profit center. So what they may do is a company will sell its logo to an offshore subsidiary. It can be even their own company. They will move the ownership of their logo to a company in Grand Cayman or Vanuatu or Jersey or Liechtenstein, and then they will pay for the use of the logo. So maybe they sell it half $1 million, and then they buy it every year at a payment of $1 million. This all comes off their taxes, and they pay the million to the subsidiary in Liechtenstein or Grand Cayman, but those places don't have taxes for these subsidiaries. So this is the trick that they use. Of course, on the face of it, it ought to be declared illegal, but when you have governments like we've had in this country, they let it slide by. But those are two ways that transfer pricing is used to cheat the U.S. government and cheat most of the citizens.
And the Bermuda inversion has come into focus in connection with, among other companies, the Stanley Works out of Connecticut. I wonder if you could, we've just got a few minutes left, I wonder if you could briefly highlight that for us.
Okay, the way that works is it's another phony bit of paperwork. It started with, it didn't start with Stanley Works, but that got a lot of press. And this is worked out by the accounting firms. Stanley Works makes widgets and machine tools in Connecticut. It's in Connecticut. It moved its official registration. It set up a new company, which is really a shell company, in Bermuda. And then, using the helpful accountants, changed its American company into a subsidiary of this new Bermuda company, which was just a shell. But since this was not a U.S. company, it could move a lot of operations to that company, and it didn't have to pay. It didn't pay taxes. It didn't pay U.S. taxes. It was not a U.S. company. All the things that a company would have to pay taxes on in the U.S. did not exist because they were in Bermuda. Now, the AFL-CIO and some other unions have tried to fight this through shareholder resolutions and also through some lawsuits, and there's some legislation in Congress saying that companies that move out should not be getting contracts from the U.S. government. The Republicans, of course, Bush, of course, is opposing this. Senator Kerry calls these Benedict Arnold companies and says that he would make it illegal for such companies to, on paper, move their registration when everything is still in the U.S. They are really still in the U.S.
Now, a couple of the companies, we're down to our last couple of minutes here, Lucy. A couple of the companies that have been involved with some of these offshore scams, of course, the Enron case was a huge, huge example of how some of these machinations can be used to deceive the public. And, of course, the Bush administration is deeply involved, deeply enmeshed with the Enron milieu. You also mentioned very briefly Harkin Energy, one of George Bush's energy companies, was involved
with
some of the same kinds.
They set up a bunch of, both Harkin and Halliburton set up offshore companies so they could cheat on their taxes.
And
they call it tax structuring. I'm so sorry to use a nasty word like cheat. They call it tax structuring. That's a euphemism for tax cheating.
And obviously with budget deficits and the general fiscal health of the United States being not only a concern of America, but the IMF has warned that America's budget problems threaten the health of the world economy. The issues we're talking about here, which might appear to be very abstruse to some people, are in fact absolutely central to the political and economic life of this country and the world as a whole. Third world countries, by the way, by way of conclusion, third world countries are also particularly viciously victimized by these kinds of scams, aren't they?
Yes, it's Oxfam figured out that third world developing countries lose about $50 billion a year through these scams, these transfer pricing and related scams, and that's almost the amount of the $57 billion annual global aid budget. It's six times the annual cost of achieving universal primary education. It's almost three times the cost of universal primary health care. And when they get the aid, they've got to pay it back. But they're losing almost that amount through these scams. And it's the Western countries who are responsible for that. The Western countries who complain that these countries have a debt problem and they're not paying back the money that they borrowed. Well, the money they borrowed ends up being very quickly moved into the banks in the West.
And so these machinations that we're talking about here are at the epicenter of an awful lot of the critical political and economic debate that's being conducted. Again, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry has been pretty active in attempting to bring at least propose legislation to bring some of these offshore banking scams to heel. Lucy, tell us briefly again about Hound Dogs and what is entailed in the launching of that, and then I'm going to give some information about where people can hear this interview.
Okay, Hound Dogs. It is, as described in the line under the title, a rebellious rag for inquisitive minds, and it is being, you can look, there is a website, a web address, www.hound-dogs.com. Hound-dogs.com. It's being started by a man in New York, a young man in New York named Hoshin Seki, and he wanted to make an investigative rag, he calls it, that would get to the stories that other publications in the U.S., other print publications were not getting to, and it's trying to get money, it's got a prototype out. It's seeking to raise more money so it can start on the East Coast and move city by city west.
And, of course, your article on offshore banking is the cover story for issue number one. Now, Spitfire, at www.spitfirelist.com, will have a detailed annotated description of this broadcast within a week or so of its airing. Sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent broadcasts are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 458, interview with Lucy Commissar about offshore banking. This is being recorded on May 2nd of the year 2004. For Lucy Commissar, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.